听力课堂，听 class.com.
Exercises 4 and 5. Listen to this extract from Paradise News and check your answers to exercise 3.
The footpaths in the Lake District have become trenches. The frescoes in the Sistine Chapel are being damaged by the breath and body heat of spectators. 108 people enter Notre Dame every minute. Their feet are eroding the floor.And the buses that bring them there are rotting the stonework with exhaust fumes. Pollution from cars queuing to get to alpine resorts is killing the trees and causing landslides. The Mediterranean is like a toilet without a chain. You have a 1 in 6 chance of getting an infection if you swim in it. In 1987, they had to close Venice one day because it was too full. In 1963, 44 people went down the Colorado River on a raft.Now there are 1,000 trips a day. In 1939, 1 million people travelled abroad. Last year, it was 400 million. By the year 2000, there could be 650 million international travellers, and 5 times as many people travelling in their own countries.
Exercise 2. Matt Dickinson talks about his career as an explorer. First, he talks about his experiences of the Namib Desert.Answer the questions in your student's book.
I believe that I've travelled about 1 million miles in my travelling career since 1976, and every single one of them has been a great pleasure and fantastic interest to me. Last year, I was fortunate enough to be invited to join an expedition to cross the Namib Desert in southwest Africa.And it took me into extremes of heat that I've never encountered before. Our journey was 5.5 days from start to finish, and we had to carry an enormous quantity of water to enable us to survive. It's a bit like carrying a refrigerator on your back.
Yeah.
It's that sort of weight. Now, the decision we made was to walk for 2 or 3 hours in the morning,and 2 or 3 hours in the late afternoon, and then rest through the rest of the day underneath a space blanket. And what we did was to stretch it between a rock surface and the desert floor, and then shelter underneath it in the shade for the hottest part of the day. In that place, nothing can survive. We walked through a great forest, and one associates trees with leaves and shade and life and energy.And all that was left were the skeletons of the trees, just the simple bare branches. It was an eerie and rather intimidating place.
Exercise 3. Now listen to Matt talking about his experience on the Brahmaputra River.
One of the most frightening moments I think I've ever had came when I was invited to join an American and Indian team on the Brahmaputra River.Which is a whitewater river. It comes crashing out of the Himalayas. It's extremely turbulent and full of rocks. And at some stages, you can see no blue water at all. It's completely white and very, very dangerous. Now, this river offers an extreme environment in every sense. It's extremely cold because the water has come from the meltwater.Snows of Tibet, and we knew from the start that the turbulent, freezing cold conditions of the Brahmaputra could give us some serious problems. Now, we were extremely lucky on several occasions to avoid being tipped out of the boat, but we all knew that eventually disaster might strike, and it was only a matter of time.As we bobbed our way down the river, often out of control, that some mishap would occur. Well, it did. We went into a wave which was far too big for our rubber raft to survive, and I felt the extreme rush of adrenaline as the freezing cold water bit into us, and I was plunged into the water as the boat went over. I felt the air being sucked out of my lungs, and as I came out of the...swirling white water into which we'd been plunged, I was gasping for breath and completely disorientated. And then it was the horrifying experience of being swept completely out of control with our raft upside down, down the Brahmaputra River to we knew not what fate. There are many differences between the desert and the savage and frightening forces of a whitewater river. The desert is not as terrifying. The river has a great deal of noise. There's the rushing of the water. There's the grinding and rumbling of great rocks, perhaps the size of a house, as they are pushed underneath the surface of the river downstream by the force of the water. But each place has its own dangers, and each place can be life-threatening if things go wrong. And I think that's the fascinating thing about extremes of environment, that the heat, the aridity, the all-embracing oven of the desert is just as dangerous as the savage forces of a whitewater river. But to be in that environment is a completely different experience, and it requires a completely different approach, both mentally and physically, in order to survive.
Exercise 6. Listen to the extract again and decide which of the words are strongly stressed.
Now, we were extremely lucky on several occasions to avoid being tipped out of the boat, but we all knew that eventually disaster might strike, and it was only a matter of time as we bobbed our way down the river, often out of control, that some mishap would occur. Well, it did. We went into a wave which was far too big for our rubber raft to survive, and I felt the extreme rush of adrenaline as the freezing cold water bit into us, and I was plunged into the water as the boat went over. I felt the air being sucked out of my lungs, and as I came out of the swirling white water into which we'd been plunged, I was gasping for breath and completely disorientated. And then it was the horrifying experience of being swept completely out of control with our raft upside down, down the Brahmaputra River to we knew not what fate.
Exercise 6. Bill McIntosh talks about work and life on an oil platform in the North Sea. Complete the timetable in your student's book.
Typically, my day will start at 5 in the morning. I will be at my desk generally at about 5:30 or 6 in the morning. The day shift crew, they will come on at 7, and they will work right through until 7 later that day. Breakfast, we normally have breakfast between 6 and 7:30, something like that. Lunch break is about 11:30 through to 12:30. And then the evening meal, which for the night shift is breakfast time, is 6:30 until 7:30. And then for the night shift crew, because bear in mind, an oil production platform runs 24 hours a day, then around 11:30 to 12:30 is the midnight meal.
Exercise 7. Bill talks about safety regulations. Look at the pictures and answer the question in your student's book.
It is particularly important to have firm and fixed safety procedures offshore. It is a potentially hazardous environment. Typically, no one can leave the accommodation to go out into the workplace unless they are properly attired. Now, that means, as a minimum, they will be wearing a safety helmet, flame-proof coveralls, protective eyeglasses, and steel-protected boots.
Exercise 8. Bill talks about work benefits. Answer the questions in your student's book.
There are a number of reasons for people wanting to work offshore. Clearly, because it's a difficult environment, then the pay scale is much greater, is much higher. There are a number of additional benefits to working offshore. One of the main ones, of course, is perhaps the free time that you can get. You do work the 2 weeks offshore, but you do get a clear 2 weeks onshore. Now, in addition to that, because it is a relatively hazardous environment, working offshore, then there are other benefits, pension benefits, medical benefits which are perhaps a little better than you might ordinarily expect to get onshore.
Exercise 10. Listen to this description of Andy's first job and answer the questions in your student's book.
I had a job once as I worked for an industrial cleaning firm. On the first day, they sent me out to clean windows on a high-rise building, and I was frightened, and I was up on about the sixth floor, and I remember it very clearly. It was an insurance company called Merrick Union, and it was a completely glass building, except for the ledges on each floor where the window cleaners stood. And the only safety feature that the window cleaners had was a belt, a canvas belt, with two ropes, one at each side, which you clipped onto hooks in the side of the building. And the idea was that you should, when you wanted to move along, you unclipped one, and then you clipped it to the next one, then you unclipped that one, walked along a bit, and clipped the next one. I was given a belt that had extremely long ropes for some reason, whereas everybody else seemed to have very short ropes, and I actually fell off the ledge. Fortunately, one of the clips was still attached to the hook, but I fell, and my legs were dangling, and the people inside could see my legs only. And the people on the next floor could see my head.
Exercise 11. Listen again to the way Andy adds extra information about the belt he used.
The only safety feature that the window cleaners had was a belt, a canvas belt, with two ropes, one at each side.
Exercise 5. Justin Fashanu talks about Torquay United. Listen and correct the summary in your student's book.
It's a small club. It has very few supporters. 1,800-900 would be the hardcore. We're a long way away from anywhere, so all the games we have to travel to away, it's quite a long journey. And it's a lot different to what I've been used to, but I'm experiencing managing here, and I'm experiencing dealing with trying to put a successful team onto the field without having lots of money and without having the luxuries that go with being a professional sportsman. So it's quite a culture shock. The players at this club are fabulous people. They a lot of them are young, and it's a pleasure working with them. The only downside of that is that we've got probably a little bit of an imbalance of having too many young players who don't have the experience to help each other when you go through bad times. And so we're tending to lose a lot more games than we really should do because of lack of experience.
Exercise 6. Justin talks about his hopes for his new team. Are the statements in your student's book true or false?
I wish that the support for the team was more passionate and knowledgeable as well, because we have a very young team here. Because of the finances of a small club like Torquay, people have to be a little bit patient because we haven't got the finished article. We've got kids learning their trade, and it becomes very daunting for these kids playing at home, which it shouldn't be. We should be able to play at home and really express ourselves and enjoy playing at home. So I wish that people were a little bit more tolerant, but I think that's society now. I think that everybody wants a winner, and they want it now.
Exercise 7. Justin talks about his regrets. Listen and answer the questions in your student's book.
I wish I'd won a full England cap and some more trophies. I think that would have been a highlight in my career and something that probably has been missing. I wish that I hadn't moved to Nottingham Forest for £1 million quite as quickly. I wish that I hadn't been injured because it was at such a crucial time in my career. And I think the last thing that I probably would have changed was that I would have been a little bit more disciplined and taking it a little bit more seriously, because everything had gone so well for me fairly easily that I didn't realize that the hardest thing was staying there, not getting there.
Exercise 9. Listen and check your answers. A.
I wish that people were a little bit more tolerant.
B.
I wish I'd won a full England cap.
C.
I wish that the support for the team was more passionate.
D.
I wish that I hadn't moved to Nottingham Forest for £1 million quite as quickly.
E.
If only I could improve my serve.
F.
I wish someone would score a goal.
Exercise 4. Dr. Marion Stacey, a sports psychologist, is being interviewed about her work. Answer the questions in your student's book.
Well, I think it's quite clear that that success really depends on three things. Obviously, you need the right level of technical skill. If you're a footballer, you've got to have an eye for the ball, be able to dribble, pass, tackle, and so on. Next, of course, you've got to be healthy and at the right level of fitness to succeed. And finally, you need to have a desire to win. This is the difference between being average and achieving stardom.
Is this as true of team sports as individual sports?
Well, I suppose in a team you can have players who are having an off day, and this is to a degree cancelled out by the ones who are fired up. It's brutally and most clearly visible when people are competing one-to-one, as in tennis, or pushing their bodies to the limits, as in athletics.
And can you actually give us some examples of how you help individuals?
Right. Well, there was a tennis player I cancelled, and she was going through a really awful period. She'd been successful since childhood and got into the national top 10. But then she hit a difficult patch and was going downwards through the rankings. She kept losing important points, and even when she was in a winning position, she just couldn't finish off her opponents. You know, she choked on the big points.
You mean she'd lost her killer instinct?
Well, I suppose you could put it like that. Although I'd rather say that she had lost an image of herself as being a winner.
So what did you do?
Well, there were two areas to work on, really. The first one was to help her deal with individual points. You know, rather than playing a point at a time, she was hung up on the outcome. So I had to train her to go through mental routines.
I see. Do you mean what you see on TV sometimes, between points where the player talks to herself and adjusts her T-shirt?
Yes, that sort of thing, but also on the internal level. You know, what the player says to herself.
Encouraging herself. Psyching herself up and so on.
Yes and no. With a game like tennis, or even more so with shooting or golf, it's a case of keeping calm, quietening yourself down, slowing your heart rate.
Because of all the adrenaline?
Because of all the adrenaline. It's important not to get too angry with yourself if things go badly. Sometimes people try too hard and completely go to pieces. It's what accounts for lots of the childish behaviour you see on court. It's hopeless to get too excited and worked up. It can be helpful just to say to yourself something like, ready, bounce, hit. Ready, bounce, hit. And it sort of blocks out negative thoughts.
And how did you cope with her image as a winner? The tennis player, I mean.
Well, in a couple of ways. I got her to write all her negative thoughts down on a piece of paper and then burn them.
What?
And to visualise what it had been like in the past, when she had been winning tournaments and so on. You know, the sensation of holding and touching the trophy, of feeling the excitement of victory.
And did it work?
Up to a point it did. Lots of the techniques are teachable, but a lot depends on the mental state of the player, how bad it is.
Exercise 8. Tina Sonnier talks about her duties in guest relations. Listen to find out if your guesses were correct.
Our guest relations department is set up to assist our guests with whatever needs they may have throughout their day here at Universal. We do everything from warming baby bottles to assisting guests that may get sick throughout the day, giving out information, whether it be foreign language information, or just assisting people with planning their day throughout the park.
Exercise 9. Tina talks about helping a guest with multiple sclerosis. Listen and answer the questions in your student's book.
Often we have guests who know that they're coming on vacation, and they'll either write us or they'll call us, and they'll tell us their special circumstances and ask if there's anything unique that we can do for them, such as one time we had a mother, a lady. She was very young, very attractive lady, about 33, and she had two small children. Her husband called me in advance and said, look, you know, my wife has been diagnosed with MS, and we don't want our children to know. They're 8 and 9 years old, and I don't want my wife to sit in a wheelchair because I don't want my kids to realize that there's something wrong here. And so what we did is we simply told them to come to guest relations and that we would assist them by giving them a back door card where she would not have to sit in a wheelchair. Also, what we did for that family was, in this case, because she couldn't wait in lines and heat exhaustion was a big problem for them, we suggested that they split their day so that if she needed to go back to the hotel, she could and come back that night. They came at a time of year where they could do that because we had very extended hours at that time.
Exercise 10. Tina talks about the difficulties of her job. Listen and answer the questions in your student's book.
The toughest part about working in guest relations is being yelled at. Relentlessly. Oh, gosh. People, sometimes, I have not always been in guest relations, and it's very hard to sometimes listen to some of the things that people have to say to you because they are just so frustrated and they are so mad and they're going to get it out of their system and they don't care what they're calling you or what they're saying. This is how they feel. And you have to stand there and listen. And it used to be very, very hard, but I think because I'm becoming more accustomed to it, it's okay now. I understand that they're just venting and I know not to take it personally. But it's hard. It's very hard.
Exercise 1. Listen to the story and check your answers.
Listen, I promise this is a true story. You see, there was this English family in France. They'd just finished their holiday and were driving back to the ferry port to cross the channel. They were driving back to Boulogne. Anyway, their car broke down, and it was really old, so they decided to leave it, just to dump it, and to go back to England by train. But they had to get this ferry, and by now, they were pretty desperate. Anyway, luckily, this other English guy stopped and said he could give them a lift in his car to Paris, where they could take the train to Boulogne instead. They got to the station just in time, and the family were incredibly relieved and grateful. I forgot to say that the stranger spoke a bit of French and helped them to buy the tickets. Anyway, they got on the train and waved goodbye. But as the stranger was leaving the platform, he noticed that the train was going to Bologna in Italy. You know, not Boulogne in France.
Exercise 6. Chris Bailey from the Bank of England talks about the production of banknotes. Listen, are your ideas the same as his?
The printing of banknotes is a very complex function. We have to be sure that our notes are as secure against counterfeiting and forgery as they possibly can be. So we want to use the latest printing techniques that are available. We reissue the currency notes about every 10 to 15 years in Britain. If we didn't do that, there's a risk that notes could easily be forged because printing technologies change. We need to be ahead of the counterfeiters. For example, one of the problems which all central banks face these days is that of the color copier machine. Notes might be forged on a color copier simply by putting them into the machine and people having a go. We keep ahead of that, partly because of the very complex paper we use, which is not at all like copy machine paper, and partly by the intense patterns and colour combinations in the banknotes, which make it very difficult for a copying machine to reproduce them accurately. We have to be ahead of the technology, which means we have to redesign the product every 10 or 15 years.
Exercise 8. Chris Bailey talks about the public's use of paper money. Listen and answer the question in your student's book.
The use that the public make of paper money is rather less today than it was, say, 20 or 30 years ago. Typically, a man or woman working in a factory today will have their salary paid to them by a check. Whereas 20 years ago, probably somebody came out and gave them an envelope with banknotes inside it. That has changed. People now, when they go shopping, don't pay large amounts of cash across the counter. They use a credit card, or perhaps they use a check. So people can economize on banknotes. We print as many banknotes as the public want to use. But the relationship between the amount of banknotes we need to print and the amount of money the public can spend has changed.
Exercise 2. Listen and complete the chart. A.
Honestly, I only borrowed it. You see, I owed a friend some money. I got into trouble with the bank, too. It was their fault, really. They lend you all this money really easily, but they get really nasty when you can't pay it back. Anyway, I borrowed the money from the shop only for a few days. I was going to tell you, Mr. Biggs, but I didn't want to worry you.
B.
£50,000! Oh, all that money. £50,000! I'll buy a new car, and I'll give some to my brother, and to charity. Wait a minute. Perhaps I won't. Perhaps I'll invest it. That's it. I'm going to invest it. Yes, that'll be the best thing to do.
C.
Oh, dear, oh, dear. Three kings to my three aces. What a pity. What bad luck. Now, don't tell me you haven't got it, Peter. I'll give you until next week. I can't be fairer than that, my friend, can I?
D.
What? You lucky thing! Well done! That's brilliant! What are you going to do with it? Buy a new car? And what about the rest? Oh! You're going to invest it. Congratulations! It couldn't have happened to a nicer person. I wish she hadn't told me. Some people have all the luck.
Exercise 3. Listen to passage D again and create the other half of the conversation.
What? You lucky thing! Well done! That's brilliant! What are you going to do with it? Buy a new car. And what about the rest? Oh, you're going to invest it. Congratulations. It couldn't have happened to a nicer person. I wish she hadn't told me. Some people have all the luck.
Unit 8. Exercise 8. Listen.
You lucky thing.
Well done.
I'm so pleased for you.
That's brilliant.
Congratulations.
Oh, dear.
What a pity.
What bad luck.
I'm so sorry.